From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Governor Rick Scott has declared a state of emergency for Martin, Palm Beach, St. Lucie, and Lee counties related to a toxic blue-green algae bloom that's left portions of Florida's Atlantic coast covered in a thick layer of foul-smelling algae muck. We'll explore how state and federal agencies are working to mitigate the bloom and challenges and opportunities for long-term projects needed to store water and restore a more natural flow of water south of Lake Okeechobee through the Everglades. Plus, thawing diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba are opening doors for new collaborative scientific research. Last year, Moat Marine Laboratory scientists, along with their Cuban colleagues, began a satellite tracking study to follow sharks. We'll explore what scientists are learning from that project. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. The improving diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba is expanding research opportunities. One study between Moat Marine Laboratory researchers and their Cuban colleagues tracks sharks through satellite tagging. Plus, if you got bit by a shark, would you become its best friend? Shark stories later this hour. But first, Governor Rick Scott has declared a state of emergency for Martin, Palm Beach, St. Lucie, and Lee counties related to a toxic blue-green algae bloom that's left portions of Florida's Atlantic coast covered in a thick layer of foul-smelling algae muck. In response, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has reduced flows of water from Lake Okeechobee into the St. Lucie and Caloosahatchee Rivers. Due to an unusually rainy winter, excess releases of nutrient-laden water from Lake Okeechobee caused murky brown water conditions on the Gulf Coast in Lee County earlier this year, disrupting salinity levels, killing oyster beds and seagrasses, and creating an eyesore for beachgoers. Joining me now for a closer look at current conditions and the challenges and opportunities for long-term projects needed to store water and to restore a more natural flow of water south from Lake Okeechobee through the Everglades is Rayanne Wessel. She's the Natural Resource Policy Director for the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation. As a limnologist and marine scientist, Wessel has decades of experience in the environmental field here in South Florida. Rayanne Wessel, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Good afternoon, John. Thank you for having me.
We're also speaking with John Campbell. He's the Public Affairs Officer for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Jacksonville District. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir.
And we'd also reached out to the South Florida Water Management District, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Research Institute, U.S. Senator Bill Nelson, and Florida Senator Joe Negron to join us, but they were not available for today's program. But I do invite listeners to join the conversation. Call 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And Rayanne Wessel, let's begin with you. First of all, since the water flowing from Lake Okeechobee east into the St. Lucie River essentially comes from the same source as water flowing west into the Caloosahatchee, why aren't Gulf Coastal areas here in southwest Florida experiencing the same kind of blue-green algae conditions being experienced by our neighbors to the east?
Well, we do have about 30 miles of river covered in blue-green algae blooms. But we have a little bit of a benefit that is provided by the marsh on the lake that filters the water that comes towards the west into the Caloosahatchee. That's the first filter opportunity that improves conditions to the west that the East Coast does not enjoy. But primarily, I think it's because we're a much bigger system. We are a 75-mile-long river versus the St. Lucie being 35 miles long. We have a lot more flow coming through our system, and it's literally pushing everything out. And so we have less residence time, the time that the water sits there in contact with the nutrients. So while we do have blue-green algae blooms over about 30 miles of the river and estuary, it's not of the same magnitude as the East Coast is currently experiencing.
Do the locks also help prevent that spread too, to some degree?
The locks will basically pool the water, so in a sense, they would make it worse.
Oh, okay, okay.
So they would increase that residence time if we weren't getting so much flow. And actually, right now we are seeing some very large accumulations right at the Franklin Lock, from the Alva boat ramp down to the 41 bridges. But it's predominantly heaviest between the Alva boat ramp and the Franklin Lock.
All right, and is a lot of this due to the kind of water quality monitoring I know that your organization participates in?
It's caused by the fact that we're getting massive loads of nutrients with the extremely high flows that we're getting. So far this year, right now, Lake Okeechobee is higher than it was in 2013 at the same time, and that was a July that was the fifth wettest on record in 2013. We are above that level. We're at the highest point that we've experienced under this lake regulation schedule. We have we've already received about 77% of all the flows we got from Lake Okeechobee in 2013, and the rainy season hasn't started. We are 10% above the total phosphorus levels that we received in 2013. So for all of 2013, we have currently received 10% more total phosphorus than we got in all of 2013, and we're at about 84% of the total nitrogen we received that year. And that was the last wettest year we have experienced. But we're talking about half a year, and we haven't even had the rainy season yet.
So how do you think that's going to bode for the rainy season? Do you think we'll see, I mean, whether or not it's this type of blue-green algae or something else, could more of these nutrients be causing problems as we get into the rainy season?
Absolutely. Generally, biologically, you don't want to see blue-green algae. Mm-hmm. They are an advanced infection, if you will, from a green algae situation, because they have the potential to be toxic. They can turn the toxins on and off. They are an indicator of ill health, and they are a public health problem. So with additional nutrients and additional flows coming into the river and estuary over the wet season and whatever, right now it's forecast to be very wet, we do predict that it will get worse.
And as far as our neighbors to the east along the Atlantic coast, what should we be concerned about regarding the impacts of this bloom when it comes to harmful effects on the estuarine and marine environments, impacts on human health, or even the economy?
Well, starting up at the lake, I think we should be concerned that we've got a massive bloom on the lake, and I believe the city of Okeechobee uses that water body as their water supply. Since blue-green algae has a neurotoxin, central nervous system toxin, and a hepatotoxin, a liver toxin, that can't be removed by the water treatment process, we should be very concerned. I would be resistant to getting anywhere in or near the water or eating fish from waters that have blue-green algae blooms. I think those are basic protections you'd want to observe. But my understanding is that there's been a slight improvement with the reduced flows. The Corps did reduce flows last Friday, and that the East Coast has seen slightly improved conditions. But that, once you've got a blue-green algae bloom, it's sort of like a staph infection. It doesn't just go away. You really have to work very hard to keep it from progressing.
And John Campbell, the Army Corps is responsible, for maintaining safe water levels in Lake Okeechobee, as well as the integrity of the Hoover Dike. How has the Army Corps responded to the current blue-green algae bloom conditions? Rayanne just talked about reducing flows of water. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Sure. So Rayanne touched on this. Last week, we announced that we're cutting flows to the Caloosahatchee by 25%. Reducing flows to the St. Lucie estuary by a third. And I don't know that anyone believes that in and of itself would solve the problem, but certainly a helpful step to try to find a balance where we're still getting a little water off of the lake while at the same time not sending as much fresh water to either coastal estuary and exacerbating this problem that has been weeks in the making. Certainly, in late June, developed into something of a very ugly sight.
And John, I've seen recent NASA satellite images of Lake Okeechobee, and the algae bloom is quite expansive there. What's being done or what can be done to address the algae bloom at the source in the lake itself?
Well, so the Army Corps of Engineers' primary concern is with managing the water level and the quantity of water that we're dealing with.
Sure.
The Corps has not authorized by Congress or the President to do any sort of monitoring of water quality or undertake any testing or anything associated with the water quality aspect. That falls to other agencies at the state, federal, and local level to actually track the water quality. Occasionally, when authorized by Congress, we'll incorporate water quality components into some of our ecosystem restoration projects, of which there are many throughout South Florida. But otherwise, the Corps has a very limited role in being able to do anything about the algae, the existing algae.
Gotcha. Rayanne, would you care to weigh in on that? Are there steps?
Absolutely.
Okay, please.
Sure. Well, for one thing, so I was going through the records for this past 6 months, and you know, what I was looking at is that the city of Clewiston stormwater has been backflowing into the lake. So they're adding stormwater into the lake that's already got problems with too much water and water quality problems. And you know, everybody got very excited about the back pumping from the EAA back in January, February. This backflowing of stormwater from Clewiston is at about 21% of what was back pumped over a 4-day period back in the after that big rain event. Adding nutrients and stormwater into an impaired lake that then is primarily being discharged to the Coosahatchee and also to the St. Lucie is not a way of addressing water quality. I think that the real issue here, and you were asking John about this, but he represents the federal government with the Corps of Engineers.
Right.
Water quality is the state's responsibility, and water quality is one of the most important issues that state government must deal with in serving to fulfill their authority and their primary role for protection of the health, safety, and welfare of the public. And what we see by having these blue-green algae blooms so pervasive across our water bodies is that for years the state has not been doing their part, their role. They have not been meeting their obligations with respect to water quality. And this is the illness that comes from that. So what we really have to do is take a hard look, stop pointing fingers at other agencies. We need to take a hard look at what will it take to improve water quality. We can see that projects that have been done for stormwater treatment areas have cleaned up water so that we can get that water down into the Everglades in a cleaner form than it comes in. But the water coming into Lake Okeechobee is dirty, and it's not meeting its threshold limits for pollution control, and what we're doing isn't achieving that. So we need to do something different.
In terms of what you just referenced, as far as the water north of the lake, I know something that's been talked about quite a bit, especially since Governor Rick Scott's declaration of a state of emergency, is, you know, storing more of that water in the Kissimmee chain of lakes before it gets down to Lake Okeechobee. Is that something we could be utilizing more?
I really don't understand the statements that have been made about holding more water in the upper chain of lakes. As of, I checked, and as of the 3rd of July, there was basically 191 cubic feet per second capacity. And if we get a rainstorm in the upper chain of lakes, that's gone. So
that's not really a viable option then, is it?
Cubic feet per second, while we're getting a combined 8,000 to 9,000 cubic feet per second. So it really doesn't exist. It's an ephemeral. It occurs when lakes dry down, but one rainstorm and that capacity is gone. anything we can do north of the lake will help to retain water, to treat water somewhat, but there is a limited capacity north. That water can then be slowly moved into the lake. But the larger portion of the solution and the problem exists for water that falls on the lake, in the lake's watershed that drains to the lake, mm-hmm. and anything that falls south. You're not going to pump that water north. You have to have southern storage in the EAA, as the CERT plan has detailed, to accommodate all of this. And yet, it's interesting because in the statements that have been made, that's the one piece, the critical piece, that doesn't get mentioned.
Gotcha. Well, I want to come back to that in just a minute. But John Campbell, I wanted to ask you just a bit about the situation the Army Corps of Engineers finds itself in. As I understand it, on the one hand, excess freshwater flows, you know, disturb salinity levels, cause damage to seagrasses, oyster beds, fisheries in the estuaries fed by the Caloosahatchee and St. Lucie rivers. But on the other hand, letting lake levels get too high poses flooding risks to communities primarily south of the lake. And in the past, when we faced severe dry conditions, the Army Corps faced pressure to release more water into the Caloosahatchee and St. Lucie rivers, and they're also facing that pressure from agricultural interests who would fear losing the ability to irrigate. Is that kind of the situation the Army Corps seems to find itself in, where there's either too much or too little water?
So one thing I've noticed about all Army Corps of Engineers projects across the nation is that there's a lot of interest. They are very large projects that impact a lot of stakeholders groups. So any particular project the Corps undertakes draws a lot of attention from people that have varied interests. Sometimes those interests are aligned, and sometimes those interests are in conflict with each other. Mm-hmm. It's up to the Corps to determine the best path forward. Certainly here at Lake Okeechobee and with management of the Central and Southern Florida project, there are lots of competing interests, and the Corps has to find solutions that are balanced, that represent the best opportunity as a whole to make things better. And so certainly management of water in Lake Okeechobee fit that to a T. On the one hand, if we release too much water at this time of year, we impact salinity levels, as you said, in both estuaries, drive them down, and there's environmental impacts that result from that. With the lake stage as it currently sits on July 6th, relatively high for this time of year, holding water in the lake, given that we still have a good chunk of wet season ahead of us and tropical systems that might develop, we don't think it's unrealistic that the lake could rise another 5 feet or so, given that it rose 2 feet in July of 2013, and that there's been multiple tropical systems in the past that have produced enough precipitation, either on the lake or in the basin to the north that flows into the lake, that have generated a 3 or 4 foot rise in lake levels in the span of a 4 to 6 week period. And if we were to see a 4 foot rise in the lake from where we are right now, we're at a new pool of record. Mm. So just short of 15 feet today in elevation, that lake level isn't in and of itself the concern. It's where we go from here. Do we continue rising? Do we rise rapidly? Because the water flows into the lake much faster than we can get it out, we've got to always assume that the lake is going to rise 3 feet before any outflow was sufficient enough to turn the tide and start driving it back down. And we've seen numerous instances of tropical systems that have produced that type of rise. So if the lake were to rise 5 feet, we're in uncharted territory. And I don't want to sound alarmist or anything like that. I just want to paint a picture of a scenario that if the lake were to get that high and the dike were to breach, and we were to see widespread property damage or potentially loss of life, that there are scenarios out there that are worse than the alga blooms that we're dealing with right now.
Right. I understand you don't want to be alarmist, but from the perspective of the Army Corps, you have to take into consideration these possibilities, especially considering where we are. And as Rayanne pointed out, the rainy season hasn't really kicked off yet.
That's correct. And I'm sure if the dike heaven knows, I don't want to deal with a dike breach.
Right.
I know Rayanne doesn't either, and none of us.
No,
I don't either. I think we can all agree
all
on that.
On the same sheet of music there. But if it were to ever breach, the questions that would be asked in terms of the water management decisions, we would really want to be able to say that we did everything possible to keep the dike from breaching, especially if loss of life is involved.
And there's history to this. In 2008, we happened to be in a drought, and the lake happened to be low. But when Tropical Storm Fay came through, the lake rose 4 feet in 2 weeks, John, was it?
4 feet in the span of about a month.
And so it's not unheard of that if that were to happen today, that is a huge problem, and this reinforces why storage south of the lake is needed, because you can offload water from the lake into an additional storage capacity south that also can protect those communities living under the lake, to protect them from dike breach, to provide a water supply for agriculture, to provide a relief valve for the system, water for the Everglades, reductions for the estuaries. There is simply no other project in the system that can serve as many stakeholders and solve as many problems as storage capacity south of the lake. But it is the one that the state has resisted moving forward with.
All right. And Rayanne Wessel, something that I've seen come up recently in the media among politicians is talking about, again, acquiring land to help restore that flow of water south of the lake into the Everglades. Senator Bill Nelson recently visited the St. Lucie River region surveying the algae bloom damage and told reporters there he'd support the use of eminent domain to obtain sugar farming land. And that's, of course, when the government effectively seizes private land in exchange for payment. The Palm Beach Post reports incoming Florida Senate President Joan Negron called the eminent domain idea, quote, a distraction from the fact that the federal government hasn't paid for its share of Everglades restoration projects, end quote. I wanted to get your opinion on that. I know that there have been offers on the table in the past for the state to buy U.S. sugar land. Is eminent domain something you think policymakers should seriously consider?
I don't think we can afford to take anything off the table. I will tell you, as a policy person working in policy for the last 11 years, that I don't see that being an easy route. It usually takes longer and costs more. And I would like for us to look at a win-win scenario where we have citrus lands that have gone fallow because of greening and canker. And we have another agricultural commodity south of the lake that is competing with restoration needs. This is an opportunity for the governor and the legislature to come in, and maybe Secretary Putnam, and craft a deal where you move agriculture out of a footprint where it's obstructing restoration to a footprint that is fallow or is out of production. Those jobs have not been those have been lost. And look at opportunities to win-win. And the thing is that it's going to take stop pointing fingers and start really focusing on ideas and concepts that we haven't tried before. Because compromise is not a bad word, but somebody's got to have a concept and take it to spearhead it to actually get something done. And it's going to be something different. But it's an opportunity, and it's one that I have not heard addressed or discussed. And I think that, looking for win-wins is what we need to do.
Right, right. I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, the cost of retrofitting, you know, abandoned grove land for growing sugar or some other crops, that's going to come with a cost as well.
That's why it would take the state negotiating, incentivizing, making an opportunity happen.
You know, given the current administration's, you know, reluctance to have the state purchase this kind of land for conservation efforts, I mean, do you see that as something that could likely happen under the current administration, or do you think we need new leadership at this point?
Well, my question for the current administration is, if not this, then what is your plan? Storage North alone is not the solution. It's an important component. We do need to look for whatever capacity we have, but the SERP plan depended on 330 ASR wells across the north side of Lake Okeechobee. We now know that only about 80 of those are possible. When the SERP plan, so you've got a chunk of water that you don't have a place to put. Add to that the fact that when SERP was done, we were running the lake up to 18 feet. We now are operating it between 12.5 and 15.5 feet, which is ideal because that preserves the lake ecosystem, the marsh that cleans our water, that provides our wildlife habitat. So the difference between 15.5 feet and 18 feet, there's another chunk of water. Then you've got the
Rayanna, I'm sorry, we're going to have to cut it short there because we are about out of time. I do apologize, but thank you so much to my guests. Rayanne Wessel is Natural Policy Resource Director for the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation, and John Campbell is Public Affairs Officer with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Jacksonville District. We're taking a short break, but when we return, we'll hear an encore Gulf Coast Live conversation about tracking sharks around Cuba and the amazing story of one Florida woman who was bit by a shark and what happened afterwards. Stay with us.